welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 496 for Wednesday, the 18th of May, 2016. I'm Dave Neal, up on the banks of the River Trent in the UK, and joining me this week, Harry Lloyd over in the Barcelona. How are you, mate?
Yeah, pretty good. I had a bit of a long weekend, so that's always nice. A bit of a chance to relax and, you know, catch up on the racing, because over the weekend we had a fair bit of racing. Obviously, we had the World Superbikes. They were out in Sepang, very wet there, but we did get a preview of what the circuit will look like with its new surface. And then also the Northwest 200 was on. So a fair bit of racing to watch, and luckily a fair bit of racing to talk about. Of course, we do also have some more Super Pole songs. That continues to be the hottest topic in recent Motopod history. We also have a couple of listener feedback emails. Ted Lumpkin sent in a rather large email that will break down into three sections, more or less. Ted's first section was about the hand gestures that MotoGP riders make, and he was basically wondering if riders have a pre-arranged, basically, language with their hands to signal to their pit crew, you know, during practice, if they need more preload or something like that. To my knowledge, I don't think they do.
No.
Ted mused that this could save a lot of time, but you have to remember that the only time that you can communicate to your team reliably is when you're doing 200 plus Ks down the straight and you're going, you know, 30 seconds, you know, not even, much less than 30 seconds, like half a second, if that. Where they can see you down the straight. And, you know, Ted was saying that this could, you know, potentially tell the team to start preparing the second bike. You know, maybe if the rider points down, then the team know that they're meant to lower the bike. But if the team's looking and going, was he pointing down or was he pointing up?
That's the thing, isn't it? It is such a short time window. And especially for GP, if you imagine the pit wall, you have literally that field of view that's about, what is it, about 2 foot, the gap in the fence that they have to hang the pit board out?
If that, yeah. You have another 50 pit boards there all blocking your view so that your half a second quickly becomes a quarter of a second.
It's an interesting concept because, yeah, there could be certain ways and means of communication, but I just don't think the time window is there to be able to carry that out.
Nah, I don't think so. I think
usually coming in the frantic waving, and as you see, sometimes it's with the setup, especially when you look at a prototype MotoGP machine, they're so intricate to set up and there's so many variables, it's hard to nail that in one hand signal as you go past to say, you know, like you say, a little bit more preload, need a little more ride height. Coming in, you see in the feedback when the camera crews cut to the desk at the back, and you see all the hand gestures there, and you can see it diving in, or they've got chatter, and I'm actually doing the hand signals as I'm talking to you, and you can't even see them. That's ridiculous for radio. But anyway, but yeah, so you can imagine the hand signals they use when they're talking with their lids on, but trying to get that across as you're, let's say, hurtling past at 200 clicks, it's going to be difficult, but it's an interesting concept.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's the big thing, is that most of these guys are going to debrief with their crews anyway, so it's easy just to do it in full detail rather than, you know, have the team start, you know, raising the ride height by a centimetre when you want the ride height lowered by 2 centimetres.
Yeah.
So I think it's just a matter of that.
I think the only thing they can do is if they want to come in to change tyres, depending on which series you're in, they can point to the back wheel or they can point down to say that next time you come, they can have the tyre warmer, they can have everything out and ready. So in that sense, they can do, but it had to be a real broad thing like changing the tyres. That's probably about the only thing that they could get away with in that respect.
And we've definitely seen a couple of riders take advantage of the of when they're on the big screen after a crash. You know, I can distinctly remember both Alex and Marc Marquez pointing to various parts of their bikes after they've crashed, mostly Alex Marquez in recent years, to notify their teams of, you know, what to change and what to get ready. So there are some instances where, you know, they do take an advantage of what's happening, but otherwise it's pretty tricky, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a good thing. We've got to keep an eye on that one, see if that does develop. Ted's email continued. Pedrosa's weight problem. For years, we've been hearing about Pedrosa's problems heating up his tyres because he's the lightest rider on the grid. I don't understand why Pedrosa's leather sponsor can't just sew some thin weights distributed carefully about his body. A fat suit, if you will. You would think that with a little experimentation, one could figure out how to distribute the weight and so the rider wouldn't even notice while he's on the bike. Other than his rear tyre reaching optimum temperature, that is. and it gives the advantage of putting the weight where you need it. If a big butt works for weight distribution, roll out the J-Lo model. Need more weight up front? Well, fill the name of your favourite well endowed actress. Anyway, food for thought. Do you know, sometimes these emails just really brighten up your day, don't they? We get some great in-depth technical emails from the guys out there listening, from you guys sending them in to us. And just occasionally, just having one like this, that's just a little bit left of centre, just really comes across. It just makes you smile a little bit. A fat suit for Pedroza.
I'm not sure that Alpenstars are going to invest in that. I know that Brad Binder, when he competed in Aprilia Super Teens way back whenever, they had to slide weights inside of his leathers because he didn't meet the minimum weight requirement. And then when he crashed, that ended quite badly for him. So
yeah, that's because that adds extra forces and inertia and everything else to weights where you're not expecting it. So
yeah, and it also reduces mobility. Like, say if you could make weight, you know, say if you just add basically, say you make Pedroza wear two sets of leathers instead of one set of leather to add weight, then, you know, he doesn't have that same flexibility.
I just had an idea that you could, do you know what, here you go, talk about thinking on the hop, why not use heavier thread in the leathers for sewing them together?
I mean, I guess you could. I think we're going to need some pretty heavy thread, eh? Like, I don't think Pedroza's issues are going to be solved by, like, you know, 100 extra grams here or there. I think we're going to need, you know, 5 kilos or so. But
as the famous supermarket says, every little helps.
Okay. Well, if anyone out there has any industrial grade thread that's made out of steel or something, then contact Dave Neal and he'll sort you out with an Alpenstars contact.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Just round up that last piece, mate. Off you go.
And so then finally, Ted has a bit of a bit of a philosophical question, I guess you could call it. And it goes, Whiskers, what's up with riders' facial hair? I realise most of them are very young, but hey, if you can't grow facial hair, don't try. Jorge Lorenzo looked like a twerp for years. Apparently he has influenced Maverick Vinales, who needs to shave immediately. Dovey and Crutchlow seem to be the only riders who can rock a beard. I give Rossi honourable mention for trying, but even he, at 37, needs to stick to stubble or stick with the 5 o'clock shadow look. I believe that the rider with the air quotes best beard is Bruce Ansley.
Ansley? Oh, no question.
Although he does tend to sometimes look a bit homeless as well. So it's sort of a double-edged sword, but yes, I do
agree. I've heard that's going, you know.
What, that everyone's going to look homeless now, or the beard's going out of fashion?
No, that Bruce is losing the beard.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, apparently, I think it's either before or after the TT it's going. Just as a little aside to that. But the one thing with the whiskers, surely that's a youth thing, isn't it?
I think it's a youth thing, and I think in general, I don't know if
just growing whiskers. I now have a beard, which I didn't have previously.
I can honestly say that I will probably never have a beard.
I didn't think I would, but I'm 43 years old, and it's taken me this long. Only because a very good friend of mine said, you know what, you look great with a beard. So I decided to grow a beard, and it's taken me 43 years. I have to drive to work with the windows up in the car. Because one breeze and it's gone. But I can grow an actual beard now. And that's only as I, you know, creep into my 40th decade, if you like. Fourth decade. But no, as a youth, no, not a chance. And there's guys at our place at work, you know, with these wispy things and everything. It's like, no, really? No, it's not working. So I understand exactly what Ted's saying in that respect. They don't kind of look, they're very patchy. And yeah, no, they're one step away from being clean. Just no.
Yeah,
he's absolutely right. And Maverick Vinales, please stop shaping your eyebrows.
That's just a Spanish and Italian thing, you know. Andrea Iannone, he has some lovely shaped eyebrows as well.
Honestly, it's unnerving.
Whatever floats their boat. But I think probably the biggest criminal in the facial hair department is Jack Miller. He really loves an ironically bad moustache, because Jack Miller is much like me in that no hopes of growing any proper facial hair. And I think that he has, unfortunately, embrace that to the fullest. And
but
now,
the difference between Jack Miller himself is Jack Miller doesn't give a fuck.
Yes, that's true.
He
as
really
well.
Doesn't.
He's in a position to be able to not give a fuck.
Correct. Exactly right. The slightly difference of positions with MotoGP. Yeah, no, it's fine.
Yep,
I want to grow a big orange beard. I'm going to grow a big orange beard. And if it's patchy, I don't care.
Exactly. But a big thank you there to Ted Lumpkin for
excellent.
His...
Enjoyed that.
slightly out of left field email. Always love a bit of a unique look at the MotoGP paddock. Definitely, especially the Pedrosa's weight thing. Not something that I don't think I would have ever thought about, but good to know that there's someone out there thinking. Speaking of thinking, Jarrett Bean sent in an email highlighting Bradley Smith's hypothesis about all of the crashes in France. Smith suggested that the pressure on the front tyres was too high at the start. Once the race started, the front tyre exceeded the working window and therefore doesn't flex like it should, because as the temperature rises, the pressure increases. There's some chemistry or something equation for that I probably should remember, having done chemistry in high school. But
Way beyond me.
Yeah, I mean, Bradley Smith's a pretty smart dude.
He really is.
I'm going to assume that could quite possibly be something, but
Could that be the potential for the rear as well, with the heavier riders of Redding and Loris Baz?
It could play a factor. I think with the rear, they're probably more likely to underinflate it to try and get more grip. But again, I'm not sure. I don't have all of the information, and I'm not good enough at the physics and the chemistry to know for sure. But definitely pressure could play a pretty big role. Obviously, after the Loris Baz scare, Michelin did raise the pressure, at least on the rear tyre.
Yeah, they did. That's true.
That could be another side effect, you know? The other side effect, I think, could just be the thing that, you know, these Michelin tyres are very unpredictable.
They are, yeah.
And that they don't give feeling like the Bridgestone. I believe it was Bradley Smith again who was saying that the contact patch of the front Michelin tyre is very much like a triangle. So it's not steady, but it sort of just keeps warping around different sorts of triangles.
Really?
I believe he said that. I think there was an article.
So it has a narrower lead than trail.
I think it can be both ways. I think that's what Bradley Smith was saying, is that like as the tire deforms, it changes a bit, and that's why there's no real feeling when you go over the edge.
Because one would suggest it'd be more oval shaped, which I think maybe the Bridgestones possibly were.
Yes, I think so. But again, I am...
As a contact patch. But then as the tyre pressure goes up, then the contact patch gets smaller. So hence the faster washouts at the front.
If anyone out there does know what they're talking about with tyres, then please do send in. Maybe if you're a bike mechanic or a technician. Because, yeah, as I said, I'm not too up to date with the physics of a tyre. I know how they, you know, work.
No, yeah, whether you work on Bridgestones, Michelins, Pirellis, the tyre side of things is an interesting concept and an interesting angle, because it's such a major part. So, yeah, guys, if you work on the tyre side of things, you work for a team, if you run your own team and you have a knowledge of tyres and how they work, by all means, we're up for educating, and yes, we'll pass that on to the rest of the listeners. So please get in touch. motopod@motopodcast.com.
If you want to send in your BSB Super Bowl lap song, you can send it to motopod@motopodcast.com. Almost forgot the email there midway through, even though you just said it, which is probably not good for me. But anyway, we did have some more people write in. We had Jules, he wrote in and sent us Motorcycle by Love and Rockets. It was a very obscure song and seemed like it should probably be playing at some sort of very avant-garde fashion show with, you know, lots of strobe lights and something, but it was about a motorcycle. So Jules,
there's been some seriously not obscure, but we have a wide variety of taste in music, don't we, as you look what's been coming through.
Yeah, certainly. I thought it was going to be a lot more AC/DC, to be honest. Not to stereotype Motopod fans or anything, but I think we've only had one AC/DC song, if that.
Yeah, we have. If you just have a rundown of the Super Bowl songs, I'll just pull up, because Michael Mulder got in touch on the Facebook fan page and there was one or two on there.
Okay, I will go. So last week,
thank you,
Jackson Brown's choice was made by a listener identified as JB, which turns out to be John Bright of Sheffield, who is TZ John on Twitter, a longtime Twitter friend of Martin's. Hello, John. That's from Martin. John's a big two-stroke fan, hence the TZ moniker, so he may enjoy a recent description Martin heard of a two-stroke sound, like a skeleton having a wank in a biscuit tin. Well, hopefully my grandparents have stopped listening to the show by now. Brilliant. John has also had a bike racing-related concussion and agrees that it's horrible. So backing you up there, Dave, with your little concussion. Bob Wright sent in Driven by Rush. Video is very Mad Max. Good song. Scott Baldwin, he chose Born to be Wild by Steppenwolf, a classic. Craig Good chose 90 Miles per Hour Down a Dead End Street, a country song by Hank Snow. Contains the classic line, like a fast motorcycle with the devil in the seat, doing 90 miles per hour down a dead end street. Hopefully you would be going a bit faster than 90 miles an hour on your BSB Super Pole lap, though.
You would like to think so, and not particularly down the dead-end street. just bringing up on the Motopod fan page over on Facebook, Michael Mulder, our friend down under, some like it hot, the power station, and also agreed with In the End by Linkin Park. Peter Newell, which I believe is over there in the California. Is he in San Francisco, I believe?
I think so. That sounds familiar.
The Jim Jones review, Where'd Our Money Go? Is that, he said that should be a good one for taking off at least a second a lap. I have to listen to these later, so I should report back.
And now we're going to jump straight into news because it's been a bit of a big news week, even though it's still very early in the week. So earlier in the week, on Monday, we had the news that we've all been waiting for. Danny Pedrosa signs with Repsol Honda for another 2 years. Several people at several Spanish newspapers and MCN probably had a bit of a tear in their eye after being led astray by a paddock source or two. But yes, Danny Pedrosa will be staying with the Repsol Honda team for 2017 and 2018. Cal Crutchlow will not be running in Repsol Honda, which I think is not really that surprising.
No.
This will be Pedrosa's 13th year of service, I believe, at the end of 2018 to the Repsol Honda squad, and I can't think of another factory rider that has stayed with the same factory team without a break somewhere in their contract for that long.
No, not in the Premier class at all, no. And I think that it's a massive show of loyalty from both sides as well. I don't know how much was in the Pedrosa story, as in, yes, I'm sure he was offered a deal, as he probably has been in the past however many seasons that he's ridden at Honda, as happens in the paddock. You know, there'll always be factories sniffing other riders to try and take on their services. And I'm sure it's not the first time.
It's worth sliding a piece of paper in front of him, right?
Like, yeah, exactly right. So 100%, I'm sure this isn't the first time it's happened. But because of the furore around Maverick Viñales and the young gun coming through, somebody somewhere has made a very shrewd move with La Pais and MCN. And they really have sold them. That's the biggest red herring of recent years.
Yeah, I mean, the only time that I can remember something as big as this happening was when a Spanish, I can't remember which Spanish website it was, but it was a Spanish website and bike magazine that got told Alicia Spargaro was going to sign for the factory's Ducati squad. And that was a source deliberately telling them that, knowing it was a lie, but that was to get back at one of the journalists for leaking a story that he wasn't meant to or something.
So that was a trust issue on that one.
But yeah, I can't really remember any other ones that were really big red herrings like this. I mean, to me, I sort of like to imagine that, you know, Lynn Jarvis in a fake moustache and a trench coat met one of these journalists, you know, on a rainy day in the paddock and whispered something and then walked away into the distance knowing that, oh yes, now Maverick Viñales will hurry up and sign that contract.
In a Mac with the collar turned up, passing on code.
Yeah, exactly.
Like the 1960s Cold War.
Exactly. Probably a briefcase left somewhere, you know, that sort of thing.
The knowing nod as they walk through the paddock.
Exactly.
But I think it's the best outcome. I genuinely think that there is nobody better at being Danny Pedrosa than Danny Pedrosa. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no. I mean, for me, it would have been really nice to see Danny Pedrosa on the Yamaha, right? It's always nice
to
see.
Yeah, of course it would. Yeah, there's no question. I'm not dismissing him as a Yamaha rider, but from the position of where he is, of being at Honda, yes, it would be great, but I'd love to have seen him do this 4 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, because unfortunately now, I think that Danny Pedrosa's title chances are gone. You know, I think 2012...
What is he, 32, is he? Something like that. Thereabouts.
But yeah, I think that 2012 was his best title shot and that, you know, unfortunately that came unraveled. And then coming into this year, lots of people thought he would be the favourites, but then the Michelin tyres changed a bit and he wasn't the favourite anymore. And I can't see him in the next 2 years, him getting any stronger. You know, I'll happily be proved wrong. Maybe riding with Danny Pedrosa will cause him to be Valentino Rossi and rise from the ashes like a phoenix.
Absolutely.
But
like you say, the 2012, that was his most defining season of recent years, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That second half of the season against Jorge, when he went on that run, something six on the bounce or something, to pull it back in the way he did, and then unfortunately it fell apart at Phillip Island.
Yeah, Phillip Island was the final nail in the coffin for him.
But showing what he did, and also what he showed at Aragon last year, against Valentino Rossi, he has got that fight when everything is right for him. But the Honda this year, even Marc Marquez and Cal Crutchlow have proved that Honda is an absolute handful.
Yeah,
you know, it's one thing it isn't is I've seen a few comments on social media and various places that the Honda's slow this year. I'd say that's not the case. It's the opposite.
Yeah, I think it's a bit too.
It's too powerful and it's too aggressive.
Mm.
And it's not the case that it's that. And trying to tame that aggression, trying to tame that power, is what Honda are struggling with most. But I think with the experience that Danny's had of riding every variation of Honda since 2006, since when?
It's a long time. I was saying.
Yeah, it is.
It's a long time.
It is. You know, that's 10 years this year. Yeah. Of every variation of RCV. So that's you're not going to replace that by bringing in someone of maybe Cal Crutchlow or bringing in an Alex Rins. Mark Marquez, you know, he's... I don't know whether Mark Marquez is struggling to develop the bike. I can't say that for sure.
Mm.
Or whether it's a combination of Mark's feedback and him taking the lead in development because he's had such an aggressive style. They're trying to build an aggressive bike to match. And that's hurting Danny Pedrosa as well as the tire situation as well. So to lose that amount of knowledge, that amount of laps and experience would be remiss of HRC because there is nobody out there to replace it with or someone who's going to sit there reasonably comfortably as a wingman for Marc Marquez.
Yeah, exactly. Now this gives Honda, you know, two more years. So with this, it seems more than likely that Maverick Vinales will now take his rightful seat at Yamaha and be friends with Valentino Rossi for exactly a season and a half before he puts through a controversial move, and then the relationship falls apart.
A season and a half? I give him a race and a half.
But, yeah, you know, it seems like there's been lots of big flip-flops within the media that, you know, everyone was reporting Vinales to Yamaha. Then the El Pais and MCN thing happened, and then it was suddenly, okay, now it's Danny Pedrosa to Yamaha, but now everyone seems to be back in alignment that it is Vinales going to Yamaha. He is in the pre-race press conference at Mugello on Thursday. So the smart money seems to be on him announcing something there. Who will be his replacement is a bit of a big question. As soon as the Pedrosa news broke on Monday, the Italian media exploded, saying that it will be Andrea Iannone going across to Suzuki to replace Maverick Vinales, and that it will be Dovizioso keeping his seat alongside Jorge Lorenzo next year.
Sure, one of those has to move, don't they? That's a simple equation, but it was which one? Weather events in Argentina have lent weight to that.
After... Yeah, I mean, since his podium in Phillip Island, Iannone has finished, what, two races? He got on the podium in Austin and then was, like, what, seventh in Jerez or something?
Yes, and the rest of the time it's been sliding along on his backside, unfortunately.
Yes, which...
So which doesn't hold... a great deal of, which is why as we spoke before, the added rumor of Cal Crutchlow to Repsol Honda to replace Danny was a similar situation. Like, well, hang on, there isn't the consistency there. Yeah. And not knocking Cal Crutchlow in any way, shape or form, but his last six races, the consistency isn't that of a factory Honda rider.
No, definitely not.
And the consistency of Andrea Iannone over the last six races isn't that of a top three factory rider, because the consistency is going to do it every time.
Yeah, it's a bit of a bummer for Iannone though, because, you know, he really was brought up into MotoGP as sort of Ducati's next golden child to, you know, try and return them to the podium. It seemed like Dovizioso was always just there as, you know, a bit of a development rider. So I hope that Iannone can do well on Suzuki if he does go to Suzuki.
The pressure of not riding for an Italian team might help free him a little bit as well.
Yeah, and I reckon that Iannone could probably beat Alicia Spargaro if that does turn out to be his teammate. Of course, Johann Zarco is testing the Suzuki during the summer break and is also racing the Suzuka 8-hour for Suzuki. So it sort of seems like there could be three riders for two seats at Suzuki. As I talked about last week on the show, there is a bit of a rumor going around, especially on Speed Week, that a LCR may switch to Suzuki Machinery as their satellite team. So maybe we could also see someone shuffle in there.
That could be an interesting move.
LCR do enjoy taking up a Moto 2 champion, so that would definitely work with Johann Zarco, albeit a year late.
Indeed, it would. Well, at least we know things are settling down a little bit in MotoGP now, so we can concentrate a little bit on 2016, and especially what. Yeah, let's see what's going to come from this now. We can concentrate on this year rather than next year. And coming up this weekend, obviously, we have Mugello. So one of the favourites on the calendar for an awful lot of people, both for the viewing public and for the riders as well.
Hmm.
And always tends to throw up some pretty exciting racing.
Some breaking news broke just after we recorded this episode, mere hours after. It does turn out that Andrea Dovizioso has in fact signed for Ducati for 2017 and 2018 to partner his once great lightweight class rival Jorge Lorenzo. So it does seem like perhaps Italian media were on the money with the whole Andrea Iannone rumour. Alicia Spargaro, he posted an interesting Instagram where it was him getting off the bike with a little wavy hand. Maybe me and some other people were reading a bit too much into that, but it definitely doesn't look like Alicia Spargaro's seat is secure. But with Andrea Dovizioso signing for Ducati and the Maverick Vinales thing expected for Thursday, that does mean that now basically the only open factory seat is on the two Suzuki seats. Obviously, we're assuming that Marc Marquez is going to stay with Repsol Honda. He hasn't officially signed his contract yet, but I don't really see Marquez making a sudden Suzuki switch. But yeah, just thought I'd drop that in there because literally as I was editing the show, I saw the news break, and that's sort of one of the big bad things about doing a podcast is that you leave it, you leave it, you leave it, and there's no news. And then when you try and get it out early, there's news. So, you know, only doing a once a week show, we're almost guaranteed to miss some things, but that's what we have next week. And before anyone asks, no, this is not becoming a daily show or I might blow my brains out. And now back to the show. I hope this flows seamlessly.
Yep, exactly. Anea Bastianini, he's still fighting to be fit for his home round in Mugello. He was out testing in Misano on Monday, along with a couple of Moto2 teams. Bastianini did 20 laps, whereas his teammate, Fabio De Giantonio, did 80 laps. So it seems like fitness could still be an issue for Bastianini.
Could be. That's a difficult season for him this year. Yes,
not the best. He's still only 18, so you know he still does have a lot of time. But definitely, it seemed like there was a lot more expected of him. You know, certainly from the public, maybe not from his team. Maybe his team were a bit more realistic. But yes, it is a bit tough to swallow for him, no doubt.
Yeah, it is. We wish him the best and wish him a speedy recovery to get back up the front there and give your man Brad Binder a bit of a run for his money.
Yes, exactly, because right now it does look like Binder could run away with it.
And I think he might do on Sunday as well.
Yes, very much so. Although, I believe it's in every Moto3 race that has been held at Mugello, the winning pair have always been within a tenth of a second of each other. So it's always a close race in Mugello.
It really is. And also, did I read today that winglets have been banned with immediate effect in Moto3?
Yes, they have immediately been banned. They were going to be banned at the end of this year, but it seems like everyone sort of just agreed that, oh yeah, we don't need these. These bikes are like tiny and why would we need winglets?
And thankfully, development hadn't gone that far that everybody was chipping in
It was only Mahindra really who had sort of stuck some winglets on, but they only did that for the first round and a half and then sort of chucked theirs in the bin.
Which, yes, it's better without. We'll see what happens with the MotoGP as the season progresses, but certainly for Moto3, there won't be any winglets from this weekend onwards.
No.
Good news.
No, definitely not. So now we move on to the main race of the weekend. It was the World Series of Superbike. They were out at Sepang on the newly resurfaced Sepang track. It seems very, very grippy, as is common in Sepang. The weekend was a bit wet and a bit dry. There were a couple of surprises, actually. Tom Sykes had to go through Super Pole 1, and he managed to get through just ahead of Leon Kamia, which allowed him to then take pole position. No surprise there, Tom Sykes taking pole position. But boy, did he take pole position, 0.75, three quarters of a second faster
Incredible.
Than Alex Lowe's. Hooey!
I mean, that's like you say, he had that extra session for Super Pole 1, didn't he, which was good for him.
Hmm.
And obviously, I mean, the one or two issues in FP3 that led him into that session. But, I mean, he bested that session by almost a second. And then to go into Super Pole 2 ahead of the likes of Johnny Ray, Nick Hayden, Chaz Davis, who's on some great form at the moment, and a showing of form from Alex Lowe's as well. But to beat them all by three quarters of a second over that kind of track, that was an impressive run. And he does have good form at Sepang.
Yeah, that was classic Tom Sykes, really.
It wasn't it? That was the Lorenzo-esque Tom Sykes. You know, it's hammer time.
Yeah,
and he looked great doing it as well. He never put a wheel out of the line. He wasn't ragged in doing it. It was a super controlled lap that took that pole position.
Yep. And then behind him was Lowe's, again proving that the Yamaha does work very well over one lap. as we'll get to, maybe still one or two issues to sort out over race distance, but it seems like slowly they are getting there. Jonathan Ray, he rounded out the front row. Nicky Hayden starting in fourth, good result from him, ahead of Chaz Davies, the leading Ducati, in fifth. And then Marcus Reiterberger in sixth, ahead of Salvadori, Torres, Giuliano, Vandermark, Anthony West on the Pedicini Racing Kawasaki. He was in there as a substitute. And then Leon Kamya rounded out the top 12. Kamya continuing to do pretty damn well on that MV.
Yeah, he continues to impress week in, week out, doesn't he? Showing that his results at Assen weren't a flash in the pan. And, you know, it's good for him and good for MV Agusta. It's nice to see him, you know, backing it up week in, week out. And then, you know, two or three weeks away from Donington Park, his home round.
Yeah.
There could be a little bit more fun and games to be had as we go forward.
Yes, unfortunately, there were no fun and games in race one because it was incredibly boring. Tom Sykes got out in the lead, and the entire race, I thought, oh, his tyres are going to drop off. This will get quite exciting toward the end. Five laps from the end. Oh, it has to be now. Three laps from the end. It's cut, surely. No, he just went. It was absolutely incredible. Yeah, it was absolutely incredible. I was certain that Tom Sykes' tyres were going to fade like they always do.
But his consistent lap times, weren't they? There was so much, a couple of 0.3 a lap quicker than everybody else consistently. And you think at some point there is going to be a drop-off in his rear Pirelli. No, and it didn't.
No,
and that's great tyre. That's a perfectly set-up motorcycle to keep banging in those times of over such consistent laps and over the distance that, you know, chapeau. I'll take the hat off to you there. It's not like it was he was hanging on for grim death at the end by his fingernails.
Yeah, 5 seconds ahead of his teammate Jonathan Ray, so that's not too bad. Chaz Davies was then 3 seconds back on Jonathan Ray, so, you know, the three superbike aliens on the podium again. And then
let's have that kind of a gap between them. That shows something, doesn't it? That there was, you know, on the setup at least, or getting used to that, the tarmac is it's a new tarmac, isn't it? In certain areas at Sepang, you could see it, especially in race two when it was wet. The difference in the contrast between the new tarmac and the old.
Half the track had standing water on it, and the other half didn't.
But it was Josh Brooks on race two. He had a quick chat with Charlie Hiscott, who beautifully quoted Kipling to Josh Brooks on the grid. Josh was apparently the surface of the new tarmac was quite sealed.
I guess. I think
it was holding the water rather than it was letting it run away.
It could be. I mean, you could definitely see that there were two distinct halves, at least on the start-finish straight. I thought that maybe it was because of the overhanging umbrella, but then I went and checked it, and the umbrella in the grandstands does not hang over half the track.
No, it doesn't. So it's only over the grandstand itself.
Yeah, so that looks to be quite interesting. Luckily,
sometimes new tarmac does that until it's bedded in anyway, doesn't it? They have a sealant on it, and eventually
I've never seen it used. Perfectly divided in half, though. That was
oh no, not like that. No, that was something a little bit unusual, as you see that the head on the typical Sepang shot, the head on shot looking down towards the start finish straight and back towards the final turn. You could see it absolutely clearly down there.
Yeah, it was rather bizarre.
Yeah, quite unusual to see. But yeah, not the most exciting of World Superbike races. We do try and talk them up as best we can, but sometimes when it's like this, the first lap was pretty intense. There was some good overtaking, and Alex Lowe's, you know, he took the lead for, I think, what would it be, 0.9 of the lap?
Yeah, you know.
Until the very last corner. But then everybody, I think it did look like Alex was holding them up slightly, and that, you know, the guy's just getting the tyres warm. Mm. But as soon as they get, you know, he led on the entry into the final turn, and he was fourth through turn three.
Yeah, pretty much. So Lowe's would eventually go on to take fifth. Torres took fourth, so a good result from Torres. Giuliano sixth, Vandermark seventh, Hayden eighth, Anthony West in ninth. Not too bad, considering that that was West's first time on a World Superbike. Just quickly on Anthony West, he has ridden in 125. GP 250, GP 500, GP MotoGP, Moto 2, World Endurance, Qatari Superbike, British Super Sport, World Super Sport. I said World Endurance, right? Yeah, World Endurance. Yep. He's probably ridden in IDM. Anthony West has ridden in a lot of Australian Superbike. He's ridden there. He's ridden in the Asia Road Race Championship. Anthony West has ridden in a lot of championships, is what I'm trying to say.
Just Moto America to go then.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I don't think Anthony West is ever going to be a world champion. He could probably maybe win a domestic series.
He has to be the most journeyman rider.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of another rider who's who's ridden in more series than Anthony West, and I can't really think of anyone apart from maybe Lucas Peszek, because he's done some world endurance stuff. He's done the IDM, and he's done MotoGP 250s and 125s. But yeah, Anthony West, you know, if you ever need a dude to come ride your motorcycle and, you know, do an okay job on it, then Anthony West is your dude to call.
Yeah, because he's not slow, is he? That's the thing.
No, you know, I think that ninth place was the best result that team have ever had in a race that was more or less normal.
Yeah.
And to do that.
We could say it's wet conditions you know, it was to his favor because he has that moniker of being a Rainmeister. But no, it was a bone dry race. And, you know, to bring it home in ninth place, you know, just over 30 seconds behind the race winner, who was streaking ahead of the rest of the field. That's not a bad return. Hopefully something will come of that for Ant West.
Yeah, definitely. So then, speaking of Ant West, he woke up as the happiest man in Sepang for Sunday for race two because it was absolutely pouring with rain. It was raining so much they had to delay the World Supersport race. So World Superbikes was the first race of the day. I quickly looked up the statistic for when an Australian last won a World Superbike round. It was Troy Bayliss 2008 in Portimao because I thought, here we go, Anthony West, fairy tale come true, replacement ride, he's going to win it. He didn't quite win it. He did exceedingly well. Anthony West managed to finish fifth, which again, very, very good result. While we're talking about Anthony West, apart from Kyrill Idampawi, is there a better wet weather rider than Anthony West currently riding in any world championship?
No.
Didn't think so. Because Rossi's very good in the wet, but Rossi's always very good. So that sort of like discounts him as a wet weather specialist.
But as an actual wet weather specialist, yeah, who has mixed results in the dry, but the better results in the wet, I don't think there is anybody at this point other than Ant West.
It's incredible. Like, you know, Vermeulen was obviously very good in the wet too, but Anthony West, just, I don't know what it is about him.
He's your man, yeah. For wet weather, that's why he needs to race in the UK more.
Really,
he does. I'd love to see him in BSB and see what he could do on a competitive ride.
He's had about five deals for BSB, so they all keep falling through.
They all keep falling through. Yeah, they do. Yeah, the Supersonic BMW and whatever he had lined up for last year, and yeah, was it this year with FS3 and one?
Yeah, he had some deal lined up for this year. But yeah, so the wet weather actually threw up quite an exciting race. Obviously, wet weather, you know, the first couple of laps were very hectic, lots of chopping and changing, but it was Nicky Hayden who jumped to the front of the race and used all his years of experience around Sepang.
Absolutely. You know,
certainly in that World Superbike grid, Nicky Hayden has probably done the most laps of Sepang of any rider on that grid. Alex De Angelis and Ant West, probably a close second and third there, but Hayden's a great test rider. He does hundreds and hundreds of laps. And they test a lot of Sepang, so he used all of his knowledge and would eventually go away to finish and win the race by a second. At one point, his gap was over 5 seconds. Davide Giuliano made a nice charge towards the end of the race, but Hayden kept it cool and returned America to the top step of the World Superbike podium for the first time since Ben Spies in 2009, race one, Portimao. Looked up a couple of stats this weekend. And this is only actually Nicky Hayden's fourth ever world-level victory in a race. He obviously won three MotoGP races.
That's the most staggering fact.
And he's one of 15 or 16 riders to have won in both the premier class of Grand Prix racing and World Superbikes.
I did see Steve Day and I think Steve English were having a chat on Twitter about that, and they did name them, but I forgot to save the tweets.
There's a fair few. Motopod listeners, motopod at motopodcast.com. I know the list. Send in who you think they are. There's a couple of guys in there who will definitely surprise you. And remember that World Superbike only started in, what was it, 1988 was the first year World Superbikes?
Yes.
So that should help narrow it down a bit for you. But there's your question of the week. Who are all of the riders to win both MotoGP and World Superbike races?
I can see this becoming a regular feature, question of the week. I like this.
Hopefully I can think of something. But yeah, Hayden, great to see him back on top. You know, Twitter and social media in general was just an outpour of support for Nicky Hayden. He's definitely one of these nice guys in the paddock. So it was great to see him back there. Obviously, the conditions helped him a bit. You know, there's no two ways about it that if it was a dry race, I think we probably would have seen something pretty similar to race one. But, you know, Hayden did it. And by Motopod math, by him taking victory, he's actually, in fact, won the 2016 World Superbike Championship based on how we do the math here on Motopod. So congratulations, Nicky Hayden. You're now a double world champion. Your trophy is in the post. So I hope you look forward to that one.
He doesn't need to turn up for the other races now. He's done a good job.
Yeah, exactly. Job done. But yeah, Davide Giuliano, he'd eventually finish in second place. Giuliano had a great charge to the field.
Didn't he just? I'd expecting him there. It really was a win it or bin it.
Yeah.
Because with the conditions as they were, I mean, it wasn't particularly soaking wet towards the end, but it was still wet.
His line around the final corner when he was coming past both Chaz Davies and Jonathan Rea, I thought, oh, no, this is not going to end well for someone, because Giuliano was taking a very different line, especially on corner exit, and I was almost sure that one time Davies was going to slam into the back of him or something, and whoo-wee.
Which would have been a return for Giuliano smashing past him on the back of the circuit to take third place from his teammate. It was a pretty monstrous move on Chaz Davies. I think that maybe words were said in the garage afterwards. But it, you know, all's fair in love and racing, and Robin's racing, as was it Cole Trickle said.
Oh, someone. But
someone like that Days of Thunder movie for NASCAR. Yeah, I think there'll be payback at some point in the future for Chaz on Davide Giuliano. But that ride of his was excellent. It was good to see him get back up there amongst the, you know, we've had the usual suspects for the last few races now of Davis, Ray and Tom Sykes. But to have Davide Giuliano up there to take the second place and Nicky Hayden taking the win, that's going to be great for him. I'm not sure the Honda's got the power to be able to do that in the dry. You know, taking nothing away from Nicky, you know, his form's temporary, but class is permanent, and he was class on Sunday. But whether he can transfer that to a dry race against the power of the Ducatis and the Kawasaki's, I'm not quite sure. But Rain's a great leveler, he shone through that perfectly on Sunday. So congratulations, Nicky Hayden. Welcome back to the winning circle.
Yep, so Giuliano would take second ahead of Jonathan Rea. Rea would nip past Chaz Davies 3 laps from the end. Davies finishing off the podium for the first time in a while. So not great for Chaz Davies' championship ambitions. You know, once again, we see that Jonathan Rea, even on a bad weekend, still manages to take 2 podiums. Westy in 5th, Michael Vandermark in 6th, Alex De Angelis in 7th. Good to see De Angelis showing well. And then after his great result in race 1, Tom Sykes was 8th. So basically lost all the work he'd done on taking back points on Jonathan in the first race, and is now...
The dry weather setup just wasn't there, was it?
No. He struggled a huge amount. He was up there in 4th for the first 2 laps and then just dropped back to 6th and then sort of just kept getting passed and passed and passed and passed.
There's an interesting comment from Jonathan Rea in Parc Fermé after the race that they're still not there with the bike yet. They're still treating racing as testing.
That's worrying if he can get, you know, a second and a third in testing.
And this is exactly what he said. If we can still finish on the podium while we're testing, then we're going to take that all day long. And that is worrying for the rest of the World Superbike fraternity, especially as he's now going to be there for another 2 years.
Yes, definitely. If you thought he was strong these last 2 years, then wait until Tom Sykes goes to Ducati and it's just Jonathan left to develop.
That's funny. Exactly what I was just about to mention, that there was a talk over the weekend of Tom Sykes potentially moving to the factory Ducati team for next year.
Yep, that rumour continues to grow. And obviously it would be Davide Giuliano who's replacing, unless Chaz Davies gets a bit of a miraculous call-up to MotoGP.
Yeah, you can't see that. I think it would be a straight swap, wouldn't it? Seat for seat between Giuliano and Tom Sykes. I can't see Chaz going to Kawasaki. He is doing wonders with that Ducati.
Mm. Yeah, but maybe, I don't know, maybe Kawasaki call up someone. I don't know what Michael Vandermark's contract's like, but maybe they try and snag him.
True. And release his full potential again on that slightly underpowered Honda. But
yeah.
Underpowered to a point, which we'll come to at the Northwest 200 when we talk about that in a short while.
So it is still Jonathan Rea who leads the championship, 257 points, which is 42 points ahead of Chaz Davies. And Tom Sykes only has 187 points. So he is 70 points behind his teammate, I think that's championship over for Tom Sykes, in all honesty.
That isn't, there's no consistency in the world. It's going to need a handful of DNFs from Jonathan Rea to be overhauled, at least by Tom Sykes.
Yeah, Jonathan Rea needs to not finish three or not score points in 3 races.
He needs to pack it in finishing on the podium.
And
I can't see that.
Yeah, and Sykes needs to win all 3 of those races with guys like Davies and like Vandermark, Giuliano and Hayden, if the conditions are right. That's going
to be all having issues as well. All need issues.
That's going to be a very tall task. Michael Vandermark, he's 125 points ahead of Davide Giuliano on 118, then Hayden on 115. So quite a nice little battle there for 4th. Torres, 103 points ahead of Camier on 73. Alex Lowe's on 70 points. Lowe's unfortunately broke his collarbone in a crash during race 2.
So he's now racing against the clock to be fit for Donington Park, as you said, Dave, in 2 weeks' time. So that is now all four of the official Superstock and Superbike Yamaha riders who've had to miss at least one race potentially due to injury. So not a great year to be riding for Paddy Yamaha.
No.
But then you look at Josh Brooks's season last year, he didn't fall off until the very last race.
Yeah, so I don't know.
Whether they're right, I don't know.
It could be a bit of riding over the edge.
It could be a little bit.
Certainly
it's hard to say.
Yeah, certainly with Gintoli's crash, it seemed like that one just came from nowhere. But I don't know. Really, really bad news for Lowe's because he was quite excited because, you know, even though they didn't get the best result in race one, they said that they did make a bit of a breakthrough with the bike. So he was a bit upset to not be able to keep going.
Yeah, indeed. Get well soon, Alex Lowe's.
Yes, and then we came on to the World Supersport race, which was originally meant to be before World Superbikes, but then it was raining too hard, so that then they put it after. Gino Rea, of course, much like Anthony West, was absolutely devastated by the news that they were going to wait till the track was drier, because much like Westy, he's a boy who goes very, very well in the wet, usually.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he does. Very much so.
He was starting in third place with Keenan Svoboglu and Randy Krumnacker taking the front two places on the grid. And then behind them was PJ Jacobsen, then local rider Zulfami Karadin, obviously a former Moto3 World Championship rider, Etten Badavini in sixth, Jules Cluzel in seventh. Another really, really tough weekend for Cluzel. Gino Rea was the leading MV, and when that's a privately run team versus the factory team, not a great look.
No, questions need to be asked there, certainly.
Yes, and then Carl Smith, who usually goes well in the wet, he was down in 15th on the CAA Landlord Insurance Honda. And then Luke Stapleford on his Triumph, he was in 17th. So a bit of a tough time being the only Triumph in that World Supersport Series.
Yes, and on a personally funded team as well. It's not a factory outfit. It is Luke's British Supersport winning bike from last year on the Profile Racing. So each track they go to, no data, no nothing that they can refer to. Apart from Donington, hopefully in a couple of weeks' time, we'll see a little bit of a return to the sharp end. But yeah, it's tough times for Luke and the Profile Racing team. It's a fresh year for them. And, you know, they're going their way step by step. It's a big ask.
Yeah, but we did have a thrilling World Supersport race. It was held on a drying track, so there was a lot of action. You know, it was your Gino Reyes and your Keenan Svoboglu's who shot out the front at the start. Svoboglu, I think he knew that he could maybe try and fight for a victory here, but you could definitely tell that he was thinking a bit about the championship because he wasn't really as aggressive as he usually is.
No, you don't often see Keenan Svoboglu is riding what you would class as cagey.
No,
because he did ride a cagey race on Sunday.
Yeah, because, you know, he only let people pass him who he knew weren't going to be a championship threat. So he let the likes of Zulfami Karadin, Gino Rea, and Carl Smith through. But then, you know, he was a bit more defensive with guys like PJ Jacobsen. He didn't really have to be defensive with Jules Cluzel because Cluzel was, 9 seconds back on him.
Yeah.
So, you know, Svoboglu very much riding a smart race. But we did have, you know, as I said, Zulfami Karadin. He led for the majority of the race. The home fans very excited by Zulfami Karadin.
They were. It was good to see as well. He's a new name at the front there as well for World Supersport, at least, to get him up there. Gino Rea, as you said, he was pushing for the win in the early stages. Yeah. Led over the line for the first lap and then was sort of holding top two after that before Carl Smith came through. But again, then they swap in the places as the track started to dry out and they didn't really get a gap. Nobody really got such a gap that it became a boring race. Everybody was quite tight. Nobody really made a break for it. Mm. And as you say, Karadin leading the bulk of the race, really, and that the home fans were going absolutely nuts until the last lap.
Yeah, so Etten Badavini, him and Zulfami were swapping places for a fair little bit, but then Badavini just managed to get ahead of him coming out of the final corner. And much like the 2012 Moto3 race, Zulfami Karadin once again lost out on victory, basically in a drag to the line, which was a bit disappointing for him because, you know, obviously a Malaysian rider winning in Malaysia would have been pretty huge. And Zulfami Karadin is comparable to Valentino Rossi in Malaysia. You know, he's very much a rock star there, even though he's only really ridden lightweight class bikes. But still to get second, his first ever World Supersport podium, so that was still really good. and you know all the marshals were immediately coming up and running to Zulfami while the you know the race winner was sort of riding around by himself. But good to see that people were excited for Zulfami to get there. Good for Ayrton Badovini to return to winning. He's obviously had a tough couple of seasons in World Superbike, now come to World Super Sport on a bit of a privateer effort. Then Gina Rea, he managed to secure third. He was just a bit too far back in those final laps and sort of eased off once he saw that it was Badovini and Kyrodin at the front. But good to see him back on the podium as well. You know, as we said, on a very, very much privately run MV effort, and Jules Cluzel, the leading factory MV, he was down in seventh. So not a great result for Cluzel. PJ Jacobson did try and get back on Gina Rea. They were quite close, but PJ couldn't quite close down that last third of a second. So he had to settle for fourth. Kyle Smith fifth after quite a good early charge. And then, as we said, Sefuoglu in sixth, taking home some decent championship points and keeping his lead nice and safe.
Indeed. And looking at the championship table, Keenan Sofuoglu top as he has been all season so far on the Kawasaki, 96 points ahead of second place Randy Krumenacker, his teammate, on 79. Third place is Jules Cluzel on the MV Agusta, 67. Then comes Kyle Smith on the Honda, 57. PJ Jacobson also on the Honda, 56. And Gino Rea not doing his championship position any harm whatsoever, leaping up to sixth place on 52, ahead of Alex Baldellini on the MV Agusta. Caricasulo, Badovini, again, he's helped himself nicely in the championship table, up to ninth place on 41. And Kyrodin, just a single point behind on 40 in 10th place.
Yeah, so, you know, World Supersport, obviously, Sefuoglu is still the favourite, but, you know, something could happen there, especially with a crash. So definitely one to watch. And once again, it was, you know, World Supersport was probably the most exciting race of the weekend. If you haven't watched it, I would highly recommend that you do go out there and watch it, because, yeah, it was, as I said, pretty thrilling, and always nice to see some new names up there as well. And now we come to the Northwest 200, and every time I watch the Northwest 200, I get reminded just how absolutely insane it is.
It really is. What an absolute race weekend. What an absolute spectacle of a sport.
209 miles per hour by Bruce Ansley.
Ansley
on a quite factory CBR, but that's
on a Paget CBR 1000 RR Fireblade.
336 kilometers an hour is what Bruce Ansley hit. Now, Andrea Iannone holds the MotoGP top speed record at 351, I think. So for what? So for about 15 Ks, the difference in cost of those two bikes is quite a lot.
It's a huge difference, isn't it?
But that's just and riders were regularly hitting above 200 miles per hour on not just super bikes, but super stock bikes. I think Hutchie did like 204 on the super stock BMW.
Yeah, he did, yeah. On the Tyco BMW, yeah, that he's been running
in.
That's
mental.
It's just crazy, isn't it? On a stock bike.
And then they're going five abreast down the coast road, all slipstreaming past each other, and riders are making up, you know, 0.3 seconds in, you know, 4 feet because of the slipstream. And if you listen to Motorpod and you don't know what slipstreaming is and you want a very good example, then go onto BBC Bikes on Twitter and just look through some of their little video clips that they posted.
Sure.
Because my word, especially in the 600cc race, if you thought that those Moto3 boys know how to slipstream, then you have not seen Alistair Seely come from like fifth to first down the back straight, because whoo-wee.
And you watch it with a grin as well, because you're watching the front four guys. They're slipstreaming each other. They're pulling out a little bit. But then all of a sudden, little Alistair Seely comes like, woohoo!
Yeah.
A lot of them. And you just can't help but smile. And he still makes the corner as well. And you just think, it is just an incredible race. It's closed roads. It's different to the Isle of Man TT. A lot of guys use it as the warm-up for the TT because of the high speeds and the closed road nature. But it is an out-and-out race over the Isle of Man, which is a time trial. So you do get the guys going four abreast along the coast, as you say. And the ball's out a corner at Church. And it just, it is another one for the bucket list to go to. It is, and it's superbly put together by the organisers over there, along the three towns. And if you guys haven't ever seen footage of the Northwest, as Harry rightly says, look it up on BBC NI Bikes and go through there on YouTube. There's all sorts. There's been a video on social media that's popped up today that various luminaries of motorcycle.
I'll include that one in the show notes.
But yeah, I was going to ask you if you can find that, mate. Would you be so kind as to add that to the show notes? It shows you the ground level view. Was it the stock race?
Yeah, I believe it was the.
The stock race one. I just watched it with an open mouth. You wait. You hear the bikes, and then you see them come past. And this is the view that you get of these guys around. And you do at most of the Irish road races. Certainly the national ones, your Cookstown, Walderstown, places like that. You know, when you are watching literally between the hedges, and this video is like a head-on shot, as head-on as you can be.
Yeah,
without being on the track, and just, what a fixed camera! Just a guy on his phone. He's you know, he's a punter. He's a fan like you and I, Harry, and like the guys listening in. He's just on there, and you just waiting.
Yeah, that's the crazy thing is that the silence. Then you start to hear them in the background, and then they just get louder and louder. And then it's incredible.
It's great. Please do turn it up. Have a listen. The hairs on the back of your neck will prickle up nicely. I'm almost sure of it. But the racing was a little bit truncated, wasn't it? The problem they have with the Northwest is that they are public roads, as we said, and sometimes they need to reopen the roads for emergency services, like when people set fire to their fence.
Yeah. So there was a I think the fence. I think we had the Super Sport race. That was the first race of the weekend.
Super Sport went off first,
and that was Alistair Seeley won that and became the most successful ever rider at the.
The early laps of that were really good.
Yeah.
Because
certainly.
Everybody was sort of finding their feet, and it was a little bit cat and mouse to begin with. But then once Seeley decided to stretch his legs, there was no stopping him.
Nah, so he would go on to take victory from Ian Hutchinson. Great comeback from Ian Hutchinson. And then Martin Jessop, he was third. So a good result from him. And, you know, you had all of your big road racing names up there as well. Then we went on to the Super Twin race, which is where we had the red flag due to a fucking house being on fire, which you don't get to see very often.
No.
So that caused a bit of an issue. And then because it was quite late in the day, the sun was starting to set. So some riders were a bit concerned about the sun being in their eyes. But then they all went out there. Before the red flag, we'd had Dan Cooper and Ryan Farquhar. They were battling for victory and having quite a good little race between themselves while the rest of the pack were sort of fighting for third. And their battle more or less resumed. Unfortunately, the race would be red flagged again as Ryan Farquhar fell from his bike and Cooper hit Farquhar, and so they both crashed. They both received medical attention. Dan Cooper had both his shoulders popped back in because he dislocated both of his shoulders. Ryan Farquhar was airlifted to hospital for quite serious chest and pelvic injuries. And luckily, it was revealed on Monday that he has been taken out of intensive care and is now on a normal ward.
Back in a stable condition.
Yeah, we don't know the extent of his injuries exactly, but it was really good news to hear that he is stable, because Ryan Farquhar is one of those names that's very much a modern legend of road racing, and he had come back out of at least one retirement, maybe even two career retirements.
Potentially so, yeah. Certainly, definitely one for this year.
Yeah, so good to see that Farquhar is going to be okay, and all of our thoughts do go out to him making a full recovery. But with their unfortunate crash, that did red flag the race, as I said, which gave Ivan Linton victory, which was good for him to take the win. Again, unfortunate circumstances, but, you know, crashes happen in all sorts of racing.
They do indeed, yeah. Ahead of James Hillier, Jeremy McWilliams at about 134 years old, I think he is now. You know, what is he, 52, I think, something like that?
I thought 54.
Oh, maybe he is. Yeah, he could be a little bit older. Yeah, yeah. He's certainly 50-something.
Even by road racer standards, he's 52. Even by road racer standards, he's getting on at 52.
And, yeah, he is.
And he was doing every race this weekend because he was filling in for Dan Neen, I think it was, who injured himself. So
Our train Yamaha, yeah.
Yep. So usually McWilliams only does the Super Twin, but this year is doing everything. And McWilliams again on the podium ahead of Jessop and ahead of Malachi Mitchell-Thomas, a name we'll get to in a bit. But Malachi was definitely one of the names to watch. Obviously a very distinct name. Sounds like he should be doing battle in Lord of the Rings alongside Gandalf, not road racing. But a great debut from Malachi Mitchell-Thomas there as a newcomer to the event. Danny Webb was also in the race, although unfortunately he did not place inside the top five.
No. The Super Twins, it's an interesting class, that. They seem to, it's almost a run what you brung, isn't it? There isn't one anything in particular that they can...
No, they all seem to be
SV650s and...
Yeah, it's all based around, most of them seem to be based around, yeah, a Kawasaki engine, but then I don't quite fully understand the class. I need to read up on it a bit because it's based on, yeah, commuter bikes or something. I don't know.
Yeah,
It's.
like Kawasaki ER6Ns and whatever, I think it's things like that. Yeah, it's an interesting class though. It's and certainly, these boys don't hang around. They're pushing 160 plus.
Yeah, certainly. But it is very much like sort of the Moto 3 of road racing, where it is the smallest capacity bikes that they have at most of the international meetings. The 125s and 250s have been more or less phased out and are now
It
mostly
has.
used in the Irish domestic road racing
And they run it
championship.
at the TT as well.
Yeah, they do. So be sure to look for those guys there. McWilliams doesn't do the TT, but most of those other riders do the TT on Super Twins as well. So that was on Thursday. At the Northwest Racing is on Thursday and is also on Saturday. Because of the red flags, they couldn't run the Superstock race, which was meant to be run on Thursday, so they had to run that on Saturday. So it was a bit of an action-packed schedule on Saturday. But we got started with the Superbike race. And it was Michael Dunlop who managed to take a hard-fought victory ahead of Ian Hutchinson and Michael Rutter. That's three BMWs in the top three. Watching Michael Dunlop manhandle that BMW is as incredible as watching all of those riders go 209 miles an hour down the straight, because he is so physical on top of that BMW. He's wrestling it round, and you can see him fully leaning over, trying to weight the outside foot peg to get it, lent over while it's still wheelieing, and it's beautiful.
That bike goes where he tells it.
It takes some telling, though. It takes some telling.
And not the bike riding, but not the bike being in control. He's an incredible man to watch. And now that's one of the great things of watching this and the TT is literally he really does. He is brutal on that machine.
Yeah.
And I think that's the only word for it. There is no finesse about Michael Dunlop. There's
no.
no elegance about Michael Dunlop. He is just brutal, and it really is. It's a joy to watch, and I can't wait to see. As the TT comes up in the next fortnight, there'll be more slow-mos of him wrestling it through various parts of the circuit. But yeah, he struggled a little bit in the Supersport race. He had issues with his Supersport bike, so he didn't get a full race in for the first Supersport.
He
Out
didn't
in.
start the first one, and then yeah, he had some issues with the second one for Super Sport. He was riding an R6, I think.
I think so.
Yes, he
He
was
got.
riding an R6. We also had the Super Stock race, the first of the Super Stock races that was meant to be run on Thursday. That was run on Saturday, and Ian Hutchinson, he took a very well-deserved victory there on the Super Stock bike. Obviously, Dave, as you know, he has been riding that in the British Super Stock Championship.
He has, and to some great effect as well, of a man who's not a particularly a short circuit rider. Of the first two rounds, he hasn't been off the podium.
No, that's a pretty good record, and especially taking the victory here, as you said a couple of shows ago, it does bode quite well for Ian Hutchinson at the TT, because Hutchinson, like a lot of the guys, like McGuinness and stuff like them, they don't really take the Northwest as seriously as they take the TT. Northwest is very much just training and, glorified testing for them. So to take a victory there is not too bad for him.
No, not at all. And any super stock bike that can do 204 miles an hour, and you have the balls to ride it at that. And fair play to Hutchie coming back from what he has with his leg
For
injury,
sure.
and the problems that he's had, and the amount of time he's had off the bike, let alone recovering from injury, the actual backside in seat time. Was just fair play, welcome back, Hodge. I think he's going to be almost unstoppable at the TT this year.
Yeah, he's definitely, the one to watch. Peter Hickman did well to secure second in that race, with Alistair Seely taking third. Michael Rutter, the old boy, managed to take fourth, with Michael Dunlop fifth. A bit disappointing there for Michael Dunlop, but I think Dunlop will come good for the TT. I think that Hutchinson definitely seems to be the favourite going into it, but
Certainly.
I reckon Dunlop could surprise, as he always does.
I think Hutchie is the favourite because he's shown so well in the British rounds. And I think even though Michael's been in British Superbikes, he hasn't shown that well, but he's not a short circuit racer. So you can't compare the two from there. But Hutchie comes in on the front foot. But I think that the moment of early Saturday was sort of 200 miles an hour side by side, Michael Rutter and Michael
Oh,
Dunlop.
that was
And
insane.
Michael Rutter looks across and Michael Dunlop just waves to him. I mean, you could tell the pace they were going, because as soon as he lifted his hand, it flat back in, as it came out into the wind shear. And he just waved at him and just carried on. It's like
just absolutely mental
that they have the time to do that on these big long straights, even though they have, as Guy Martin pointed out, they've stuck the chicanes in over the last couple of years. And when you see that they're doing 204 miles an hour, 209 on the superbike with the chicanes in it, you know, there is a bit of a reason for the chicanes being there. Because imagine what they would do without.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, they're doing that. Maybe wouldn't they go much faster, but they'd be doing those speeds for longer.
I don't know. I definitely wouldn't want to be an engine being run in a superbike at the Northwest 200, because I can't imagine that your life as a BMW engine would be very long, and it would probably be quite painful as you're constantly just being revved to your absolute maximum down these massive straights. I mean,
yeah, being revved to the nuts and that. But in Hutchinson set a new lap record in the Superstock of 122.702 miles per hour on his final circuit. So
that's
like a 9 mile circuit, and it's about 4.5 minutes and something daft like that.
That's not bad. You know, definitely if you need to get a letter to the post office before it closes, Ian Hutchinson is your man.
He's your man. He really is. Peter Hickman, second place in the Superstock race. He was leading it early on. And, you know, he is your crossover man, isn't he, of recent years now. So Brooksy didn't quite carry it through, did the TT for a couple of years and then had commitments elsewhere. But your absolute crossover man of the last couple of years, you know, hats off to Peter Hickman and to the GB Moto boys for putting that Kawasaki together. It's not as quick as a Tyco BMW, there's no doubt about it. But, you know, fair play to Pete Hickman for that. That's an impressive ride on only, I think, his second year at the Northwest.
Yeah, Hickman's definitely getting stronger. And I'm not sure he'll be in contention for a TT win, but, you know, definitely a podium contender.
I think,
sure.
I think, you know, you need a little bit of luck at the TT. And I think with a little bit of luck, he could come away with a podium position at the TT, yeah.
And certainly give it a couple of years. You know, he's one of those guys who's going to be around there for a bit longer than the likes of McGuinness. So, you know, he could definitely be one to watch as an air quotes future star of road racing, because road races
indeed
do tend to be a tiny bit older.
But the old adage is of the TT, you know, it takes you 3 years to learn the course.
Yeah.
And if he's already holding, you know, he's already lapping at 132 plus, you know, and only, you know, okay, he's maybe not going to need all 3 years, but, you know, he is a contender. He's certainly a top six.
Yeah, for sure. Guaranteed.
Contender,
guaranteed.
No question. So, yeah, congratulations to all the boys on the Superstock race.
Then we came to the second Supersport race of the weekend. Again, it was Alistair Seely who took victory ahead of Martin Jessop. And Peter Hickman again featuring on the podium on the Kawasaki, the Trooper Beer, who are sponsored by Iron Maiden. And as he was sponsored by Iron Maiden for the Supersport races, he was running 666, because of course he was.
The Number of the Beast, which is an Iron Maiden album.
Yes. And then in fourth in that race was Malachi Mitchell-Thomas. Great results for the newcomer ahead of Dean Harrison, Lee Johnson, James Hillier, John McGuinness in eighth, which McGuinness to finish eighth on the Supersport bike at the Northwest, where he's never done particularly well, is quite good for McGuinness. And much like last year, I think that McGuinness, you know, could also surprise at the TT, and especially come senior day when the pressure's really on, then I wouldn't rule him out.
No, not at all. And that's something you got to look at with Peter Hickman as well as with John McGuinness. They're not the lightest of guys. When you're up against, who was it? I can't remember who said it. It might have been Hickey when he said, when you're up against Alistair Seely, who has the body of a 7-year-old. You're never going to catch it. You know, he has that. It's the Pedroza thing, is it? It's the lightweight and, you know, and the power to weight ratio. You've got Hickey at 6'2". You've got John McGuinness, who must be, you know, with the greatest of respect, he is 12 stone.
Yes, he himself points out that,
conservatively speaking,
top end speed is not where John McGuinness is strongest.
No, it isn't. No, but it is for Alistair Seely, as we witnessed with the slipstreaming, and on the Supersport bike, it works really well. On the bigger bikes, maybe he hasn't quite got the stature to muscle those around and do what he needs to do in current company.
Hmm.
But yeah, and again, mate, a record-breaking Alistair Seely, the most successful rider at the Northwest 200, as he surpassed Robert Dunlop's record number of wins this weekend.
Yep, certainly a great weekend there for Seely. He probably would have liked to have had one or two more wins. I'm pretty sure that all of the Northwest coverage is on the BBC
Northern Ireland iPlayer website, and I think that that's not region locked. So be sure to at least give that a bit of a search, because as we said, you know, the Northwest is a great event. There is some great racing, but unfortunately, as is all too common in road racing, the event was definitely tarnished by the tragic incident that occurred in the second Super Twin race. The race was going quite well. Ivan Linton was again in the lead quite well. Martin Jessup and Malachi Mitchell-Thomas were having an absolutely incredible battle for second place. Martin Jessup was not too happy with one or two of the moves that Malachi Mitchell-Thomas put through on him at the final chicane. But Jessup was eventually able to break away from Malachi Mitchell-Thomas. But then, unfortunately, the red flag did come out, and about an hour and a half delay followed, and then it was revealed at the end that the meeting had been cancelled due to the unfortunate loss of Malachi Mitchell-Thomas. He was 20 years old and was in many regards the Marco Simoncelli of the road racing world. Credit to Steve Parrish for that one there. He was only a newcomer, but as we saw in the Supersport race, he was fourth. And when he unfortunately did pass, he was in a podium position in the Super Twins race, which to do as a newcomer is incredible. And, you know, he'd done very well at various domestic road racing events in Ireland. And yeah, he was really, you know, being lined up to not only be the next big thing, but maybe even the next Guy Martin. You know, he had that look about him. He had a funny little moustache and wore a floppy hat. And, you know, his underleathers were bright pink, bit out there, bit Jack Miller-esque. So, yeah, a huge loss for him. And we're going to include a couple of links in the show notes to some various pieces, an interview with his father, which is very touching, and then also an obituary that the Belfast Telegraph did, which is you know, very, very nice for him. And it has been nice to see the outpouring from, you know, from everywhere in motorsport for Malachi Mitchell-Thomas.
Indeed. Rest in peace, Malachi Mitchell-Thomas. On that note, racing does continue. Motorpod will continue. We'll be back next week. We have Mugello MotoGP coming up this weekend and BSB from Brands Hatch. So until next week, stay safe and thanks for listening.